Okay, true confession time. How many people have watched at least one episode of American Idol? Go ahead, raise your hands. No elders will show up at your house. Okay. Thank you. What is it about American Idol that fascinates people so much? I'm talking about the early shows. You know, if anybody watched the early shows, you know, the later shows are the ones where the people that can actually sing are, you know, performing and dueling it out, and, you know, they have Barry Manilow night and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But now, I don't actually watch all that much American Idol. So. I did. Yes, I did. But I'm talking about the early shows where they're, like, auditioning the great unwashed, you know, they have everyone and everyone, you've seen the lines, they come in these people come in that are convinced that they are the next singing sensation in the entire world, and it's very evident that they cannot hold a tune even in the shower. If you're an empathetic person, it's very painful to watch this because, you know, these people are trying really, really hard, but they cannot sing. And you know, I've sat there and I've tried to figure out, you know, what is it that draws people to this television show? I mean, what is it that people like to watch about watching people who can't sing? And you know, I think part of it is it's what happens after the singing stops. Because what happens after the singing stops? Yeah, you get. The judges get to weigh in. You have, you know, one particular one that this guy just really annoys me. I don't know about you, but you know, Simon, right? He's the British guy that just this guy can't say anything nice about anybody. He's, you know, how would you describe his opinions generally? You'd use the word ridiculed. That's one. I mean, what kind of stuff does he, is, you know, when you're a parent of homeschoolers, you know, you're always taught to, you know, say positive, give people positive feedback and, you know, that kind of thing. Does Simon give people positive feedback? No. He's caustic, he's mean, he's abusive, you know, he's just not a nice person. And if you think about it, there's a lot of on television today that's just like that. Most of the survival shows, most of the reality shows, you know, it centers around this concept of telling people what you think of them. You know, telling them that how they don't measure up, how they can't cut the mustard, you know. Anybody remember the TV show The Weakest Link? Anybody see that one? Yeah. I only watched it a couple times, but this lady that was on The Weakest Link here, she's this British kind of, why are all the mean people British? I don't know, understand what it is, but they had this British lady, her name is Anne Robinson. I looked her up on Wikipedia yesterday. You know, they'd go through this thing and, you know, all the players vote on, you know, who's the weakest link, and this lady would stand there with her British schoolmarm look and say, "You're the weakest link. Goodbye." And, you know, the person would have to walk off and, you know. On these shows, it's all about finding out who the weakling is, right, and voting them off the island. You spend much of the episode doing some really hard thing like eating bugs or crawling through some pit with snakes in it. And then there's lots of tension, you know, everyone's worried about, oh my gosh, how am I doing, you know. Of course, it's broken up by plenty of commercials, but then you have this big confrontation at the end, and everyone votes, and someone gets voted off the island. You know, they're the weakling, they're the person who's not going to cut it. They're not going to be the survivor. Why does this appeal to people so much? So if you think about it, a lot of television today, a lot of the reality stuff, you know, the sitcoms or something else, but a lot of the reality stuff is this way. You have a group of people, and the point is to find the people who don't belong and get them out of there. Often in the most rudest, confrontational manner possible. You're the weakest link. Goodbye. I love that lady. The world places much value on frankness, on telling people that they don't belong, that they're not going to make it, and that we'd all be better off with you out of here. And it's really sad, but it shows how the world thinks and what it values. Our verse from the Beatitudes today is the opposite of what we're talking about. It's the anti-Simon Cowell. So turn with me to Matthew 5. And we will read the first five verses. Matthew chapter 5. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. He opened his mouth and began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth." Today we're talking about verse 5. Blessed are the gentle, my Bible says. Some of you probably have Bibles that say, blessed are the meek. It's the same word. What pops into your head when someone uses the word meek? It's not a word we use all the time, but if you hear someone using that word, what pops into your head?
Humility.
Humility, okay. Weak, okay. Yeah, it's a similar sounding word, and that's what people think, you know. Weak.
Doormat.
Okay. Yeah, someone that someone could just walk all over, take advantage of. Absolutely. You've probably heard the phrase, gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Right? You ever heard that description of Jesus? You know, I remember back when I was a kid in Sunday school, you'd see these pictures on the wall, and it'd be Jesus there, and he's got a lamb over his shoulder, and, you know, he's gentle Jesus, meek and mild. And I guess the people who wrote those lines don't remember the time that he, you know, made a whip of cords and cleansed the temple, or when he pronounced the woes on the Pharisees. So someone give me a good definition for gentleness or meekness. Brenda gave me a good one. Humility. What else? The one that I've used before is strength under control. Right, humility up here. That is a word picture I've used before in my Bible studies because we've come across it both in Ephesians and in James. Picture the job of gentling a horse. You start out with a wild horse, one that no one has ever ridden on before, might not even be used to people being around it, and it's certainly never had a rider on its back. And what is that job like? What are you trying to do? Trying to make this horse so that it could be ridden or used for something useful, right? You're progressively going through the job of getting the horse used to the bridle, used to the bit in its mouth, used to having a rope around its neck. And you've probably seen things on television where someone is doing this. And, you know, the horse is, first of all, just completely spooked by the fact that there's even just a person in the corral with them. And, you know, and you try to put a rope around his neck, and it's just, you know, forget it. The horse is jumping all over the place. And you know, the whole purpose of doing this is to get the horse under control, because you're trying to do something useful, some useful work with this horse. Maybe you're going to pull a load with it. Maybe you're going to use it for transportation. You're trying to bring this tremendous strength that is a horse, and if you've ever been around a horse, you know they're big and they're strong. Melissa rides horses at a little place next door to us, and she always comes back with these horrible stories about, you know, her trainer got kicked in the jaw, and, you know, the jaw was wired shut for 2 months, and, you know, broke 3 ribs, and her trainer was like, you know, they're terrible stories. Because these things, these animals are so big and strong, and the horses that Melissa and her trainer ride are used for equestrian events, they're highly trained, and yet they're highly strung horses. It's not like, you know, the little pony at the little sideshow circus that, you know, would never, you know, bat at a fly. These horses are like, you know, wired up. These horses drink coffee, I'm convinced. But you're trying to bring all this tremendous strength under control, because then you can get this horse to do these very elaborate maneuvers, and, or, you know, if it's a cowboy horse, you're trying to get it to, you know, help you get the cows in line and do all that kind of stuff. Well, that's what gentleness is. It's bringing strength under control. You're bringing a tremendous amount of power under control. Now, the word that's rendered as gentle or meek in verse 5 here is the Greek word praus, and it's translated as humble, it's translated as gentle, as meek. It really is a logical progression of the first two Beatitudes. We start out with the blessed are the poor in spirit, right? Those who understand that in God's presence we bring nothing to the table. We have nothing to bring, you know. God is a holy God, and there's an understanding that we are not. We are spiritually poor, and we know it when God opens our eyes and allows us to see His holiness and His righteousness, and the fact that there's this gulf between who He is and who we are. It's His work. And it's a result of it is spiritual poverty. It's our realization that we are spiritually poor. This moves into, you know, blessed are those who mourn, because it's an outgrowth of this spiritual poverty. First, you understand that you're spiritually poor. You understand that God requires of us holiness and righteousness, and you understand that we can't get there. And so you mourn. It makes you sad. It causes you to have sorrow. We're truly sorry about our sorry state, if you will. We know that God wants us to lead lives that please Him, and yet we can't do it. We mourn. Jesus says we shall be comforted. And now we have blessed are the meek, or blessed are the gentle. Now watch this. Meekness is poverty of spirit, but it involves the horizontal relationships that we have. Poverty of spirit, the first beatitude, has to do with the vertical relationship. Here I am, and here is God, and I understand that I'm spiritually poor. Meekness is that same understanding, spiritual poverty, but in relation to other people. Gentleness is always in the context of other people. I generally can't be gentle or meek if I'm all by myself up on a mountain someplace. I'm gentle with other people. I'm gentle with others. It's talking about our relationships on the horizontal level here. So it involves questions like, how do I treat other people? How do I relate to them? Meekness is poverty of spirit with regards to others. It's having a true and accurate view of ourselves in our attitudes and with respect to our behavior to others. It's knowing that I am fallible, fallen, and flawed when I am around others. Humility is knowing who we really are and knowing that it should affect how we treat others. So if we truly understand our fallibility when we are around others, how are we going to treat others when we're interacting with them? How? How would understanding our fallenness, our sinfulness, our...
Treat him with grace.
Okay, treat him with grace. Yeah, knowing that grace has been extended to us, we would treat others with grace, right? Okay. Try to overlook a transgression. Someone steps on your toe. It's not flying off the handle at them. Because I know that I've stepped on plenty of toes myself, right? Yeah, if someone treats us badly, it's the realization that, yeah, I've treated people badly at certain times. There have been times when I've said an unkind word to someone. Absolutely. We're going to be gentle with them. We're going to understand that we do the same things. We're going to be honest with ourselves and say, this is the way I am sometimes. Now, there's plenty of examples of meekness in the Bible. Let's turn back to Genesis 13. We'll look at one. Genesis 13. We'll read the first 12 verses here. Now, kind of get your bearings here. Just to the left of Genesis 13 is Genesis 12, where God gives Abram this announcement of this covenant that he's made. So this is after the covenant. Genesis 13. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife, and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. He went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right. Or if to the right, then I will go to the left." Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. So you have this story. It's always amazed me when I've read it, because Abram here is showing gentleness and meekness to Lot. Now, who is Lot in regard to Abram? He's his nephew. He's the son of his brother, I believe. Now, in the previous chapter, like I said, what is happening? You've got God making this covenant with Abram. And he's saying, "I'm going to make of you a great nation. I will make your name great," it says in verse 2, chapter 12. Now, this has got to sound pretty neat to Abram, you know, right? You know, God comes and says, "I'm going to make of you a great nation. I'm going to make your name great. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you." So Abram's got to be feeling pretty good about this, I'm thinking. You know, Abram's thinking, "Wow, nice." Now here we are in chapter 13, and Abram and Lot both have large herds, a lot of possessions, a lot of sheep, and their herdsmen are arguing because there's a little tension there. The resources are scarce, they're kind of all in one big thing, and all the grass is getting eaten, and the herdsmen are arguing. And how does Abram respond? Does he say, "Hey, I'm the one that God made the covenant with me. You get lost. You're the weakest link. Goodbye." You know, Abram was a lot older than Lot. He was a whole generation ahead of Lot. By rights, he should have been shown more respect. He should have had the choice of the best lands. But that's not what happened here. Let's look at verse 8. Verse 8 says, you know, Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me." He says, "Is not the whole land before us?" He says, "Lot, you pick. You take what you want, and I will take the other." Now they're standing there, probably on the brink of the Jordan Valley. You can look down into this valley if you've ever been there. And, you know, the valley is green. It's lush. You know, it says it was like the garden of the Lord. And Lot picked the pretty part. He picked the green part. He picked the fertile part. He took the best land for pasturing flocks. Abram got the hilly, rocky, dusty, dry part. I have been there. It's not the Garden of Eden. I still don't understand why people like to fight over that place, but they do. But it's dry, it's dusty, it's rocky, it's hilly. It's not very pretty. And Lot said, well, here's the pretty part. I think I'll go here. And Abram said, okay, I'll go here. He didn't pout. He didn't mope. He didn't He gave Lot the preference. That was gentleness. That was meekness. Abram knew that God would bless him no matter where he went. He says, okay, God can bless me on the dry, dusty, rocky part. I'll take that. We see this character in Jesus. Many times people treat him badly, and he responds with gentleness. And his teaching is that of gentleness. Turn back over to Matthew 5, a little bit later in the chapter. Matthew 5, 38. Now this is just a little bit lower down into the Sermon on the Mount from the Beatitudes. Jesus is saying, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Your Bible might even have that in the capital letters, which means that it's a quote from the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament doesn't actually say that. There was a law of retaliation. Jesus says, I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Jesus is saying, this is how believers act towards other people. Now, this is revolutionary teaching. This had to blow people's minds, blow the circuit breakers. Because you have the law of retaliation. It's there. And Jesus is saying, no. My followers will not resist the evil person. Turn the other cheek. If someone sues you for your shirt, give him your coat also. In our horizontal relationships, the believer is to act towards even the evil person with gentleness. Now, what's the worldly response to someone who strikes us? Sure, hit him back. Right?
Payback is double, right?
Payback's double, absolutely. What's the world's response to someone who takes my shirt? Well, you go and you beat them up and you get your shirt back and you take their shirt too, That's the world's response. Gentleness, meekness, is the trademark of the Christian. The world is not like this. The world cannot be like this. It's impossible. Now think about this scenario. You're at home and a fellow believer, a good friend of yours, calls up and says, hey, I'd like to talk to you. He comes over and he says, I'd like to talk to you in private. You swallow hard, and he or she gets you by yourself and tells you something in your life that they've observed that doesn't match with your being a Christian. How do you respond? When someone turns the switch light on and shines it on your life, how do you answer? That's the litmus test of meekness. Are you a defensive person? If someone challenges you, do you do your best to defend yourself? Do you try to justify your actions, or you respond, yeah, you got me there. You're right. Poverty of spirit is okay if we're the ones pointing to ourselves and saying, I am poor. But let someone else point the finger at you, and we generally resent it. We defend ourselves. We say, but you don't understand how stressed out I've been, or whatever excuse we might come up with. Or we might say, you have no right to judge me. Gentleness is allowing others to point at our faults and agreeing with them that, yes, we're flawed. We're fallen, and we know it. It's saying, God is not finished with me yet. Now, gentleness is also being in the other place. Let's say you've observed something in someone else's life, and it's your place to go to them and confront them. And you could go over and point the finger and really let them have it and say, you'll know what that looks like, right? Or you could come alongside them, tell them that you love them, tell them the truth in a way that looks, that says, look, we all struggle with these things, but here's something in your life I've observed. So here's a checklist of things you can use to check yourself on the meekness gauge, and I encourage you to write these down and spend some time this week doing some serious reflection on how you're doing. I'm going to try and write these down with you. These are things that you will exhibit if you're a gentle person. I didn't come up with these. I got them from Martin Lloyd-Jones' book, The Sermon on the Mount, which is a great book. First, there's a complete absence of pride. That thing likes to fall down. Humility, true humility, not the false kind, but a real lack of pride around other people. You're not tooting your own horn. You have a realistic view of your faults and those things that make you fall out of fellowship with God and with others. Second, you are one that's given up their rights. You're not standing on a chair yelling, hey, that's not fair. You're not demanding that people treat you right because you're a certain age or you're someone special. Recognizing that you have no rights means that you're not trying to ensure that you get your fair share of something. Attention, recognition, power, ability to choose, right? Abram gave up his right to choose. Your right to have it your way. And this is one that's really hard for us because America is a nation of people demanding their rights. Now we turn everything into a right and then we demand that we get it. The meek person has given up all that. Third, you're not sensitive to criticism. A Now, this one is hard. We all get criticism in many shapes and forms. Our spouses are able to make observations that are generally right on the money. Dangerously correct. People at work might take pot shots at us. Someone in traffic might not like how you're driving. Might give you a little sign of correction there, or others. How do you react when someone toots their horn at you? I fail that one. The meek person listens to criticism and examines it in the light of who they really are, with honesty. Some wise person once told me, you need to listen to criticism. There's generally a negative truth in it. And even if the criticism is completely unfounded, does it still bother you? And you got to ask yourself, why does it still bother you? It's not true. Fourth, we talked about this one, you lack a spirit of retaliation. Getting even is not part of the Christian character. When someone has wronged you, how do you respond? Do you plot getting even? Or do you pray for those who persecute you? Jesus said, love your enemies. He said, if you love those who love you, what good is that? He says, don't even the tax gatherers do that? And even if you're not plotting to harm someone else in response to them harming you, do you withhold your attention, your friendship? Do you withhold a kind word? The gentle Christ follower has no part in that. Fifth, you are patient and long-suffering. Anybody hurting out there yet? Are there people who drive you crazy? Are there people that do something that you just can't take anymore? You're that person for some people. Okay, well, that's something else. We'll talk about that. The gentle person understands that God puts up with all kinds of stuff from us and loves us anyway. The big and the little things, right, that we do that are an affront to God. So the gentle person understands that the least we can do is to put up with, to be patient with, and suffer long with those around us, saved or unsaved. The unsaved don't get, you know, we don't get to treat them differently. Whoever it is that you rub shoulders with, is patient a word that people would use to describe you? Sixth, you have a teachable spirit. teachable spirit. Are you always looking for what God is trying to teach you through the people that He's put in your life? Because we all have people in our lives, and I'm firmly convinced that God uses them to teach us things. The great thing about kids is that they're always teaching you something. And the parents in the room will smile and nod. And we parents might not want to learn the lesson always, but there's always something to learn. Your wife or your husband is a mighty tool of God in your life. Are you a teachable person? Is your mind and your heart open to outside influence? Or are you a closed book? Already cooked. Got it all down. Don't need any more input. Thank you very much. So take some time this week and examine yourself on these six things. It's kind of a challenging list. So, anybody have any questions for me on meekness before we close today? This is the first time I've ever asked this. Jeremy does it all the time. Nobody ever asks him anything. All right, well, I have a couple questions for you. First one is meekness compatible with strength? Gary brought up the fact that meek generally in people's minds equals weak. Is meekness compatible with strength? Absolutely. Okay.
It has to be, because if something's just weak, then that word really doesn't apply. That's not the meaning of the word. A lot of people mistake meekness for spinelessness or the doormat, something like that.
Right.
But that's not what the word means. And your illustration of gentling a horse is a good example. If you can train a horse, does not become less strong. It just becomes more useful.
Yep.
So if we, by that work of God in our hearts, become meek, it's not that we're not stubborn anymore. It's that now we can focus our stubbornness on something positive, and that's called diligence now.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't go away. It just got useful.
Right. Yeah, Jesus is a great example of meekness that is also strong. Jesus was a very strong character. Any portrayal of Jesus Christ that turns him into milquetoast, doormat, that this doesn't apply to him. So there can be tremendous strength there. It's just that it's channeled. It's useful to God. We talked about Abram being an example of meekness in the Bible. Can you think of any others?
Apostle Paul.
Okay. How so, Gary?
Misunderstood his meekness and gentleness towards them.
Right, they interpreted it sort of weakness, right? Okay, it is. Anybody else think of another example? There are lots of them.
Another example of Paul is in his letter to Philemon. He says, although I have the confidence in the Lord to command you what to do, I would rather appeal to you.
Yeah.
He doesn't command you. He says, here's what you ought to do. There's confidence in God, but there's also that attitude. I don't need to swing this stick.
Yep. Right. Yeah, tremendous meekness and gentleness. Yeah, Jesus is a great model for us of gentleness and meekness. I think others you ought to think about are Moses. You know, Moses was a scaredy cat, lacked confidence. But, you know, all through Moses' life, you see places where he could have just completely let people have it, and he didn't. He said, God, kill me. Don't kill them. David is another one. I think there are lots of examples there. Because it defines the true believer's character. That's what Jesus is doing here in the Beatitudes. What are some obstacles to gentleness that keep us from doing that? Yeah, selfishness, pride.
Afraid somebody might think we're the weakest link.
That's right. No, nobody wants to be the weakest link, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think about society and how they look at people, and you know, that colors us, folks. I mean, we live in this weird, strange, warped, fallen world. And it's easy to get caught up in that. It's like, I don't want to look like that. All right, well, let's close in a word of prayer.